to about 500,000 in a very short time. And the dangers these various trains pose to the population of the areas they go through. But the other message, of course, is that when this oil is burned, wherever it's burned, whether it's burned in a horrific explosion in Lac-Mégantic or whether it's burned in the cars and trucks and other industrial uses here in America or in Asia, it doesn't matter. One atmosphere, one planet, and the great calamity of climate change and global warming, which is not rapidly approaching, it's here already, as we have paid attention to here in Portland the last few days. But the fact that the entire world is facing catastrophe, and that the oil companies and the leaders of the world seem more interested in short-term profits than in long-term survival of the human species and literally thousands of other species that will perish.
We have only one planet. Lone, before we let you go, you've been very generous with your time. Thanks for that. Where can listeners go to participate and to take action?
Well, this event was sponsored by the Climate Action Coalition, which is a coalition of 9 local climate groups, including I won't name them all, but certainly Portland Rising Tide, PDX.
What's the next event that's coming up we should know about?
Well, I'm not sure, but the best thing to do is to go on the Climate Action Coalition website or the Portland Rising Tide website. Either one, just do a Google search for Climate Action Coalition Portland, and you'll get on the website and you'll see how
that's where we get, you can get all the info. Listeners, Loan, thank you so much for that. I want to thank both of our guests, Antonia Jules and Loan Persing Berman with Rising Tide Portland. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, July 6, 2015. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Of course, Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks for that, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Hi, this is John Schuck, host of Religion for Life. Alex McNeil is the executive director for More Like Presbyterians, an LGBTQ advocacy group in the Presbyterian Church USA. Alex is the first openly transgender leader of any organization in a mainline denomination, and he talks with me about next steps for LGBTQ justice in the church.
Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
Attention, KBOO members. You are invited to give your feedback on KBOO's draft mission and vision statements. Based on member feedback from the recent survey and member retreat, KBOO board and staff members created draft mission and vision statements. Now we want to know what you think. This is your chance to help define KBOO's guiding principles and priorities. Visit KBOO.fm to review the draft mission and vision statements and submit your comments. Paper copies of the draft statements are also available at the station. Comments are due July 17th. If you have questions, please contact Monica Beamer at monica@kboo.org. Thank you for contributing to the development of KBOO's mission and vision statements and for your support of community radio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Arctic is a showcase for the effects of climate change, especially with the alarming decline in the extent of summer sea ice and its amplifying effects on warming. The region is an area of contention as well, as the expansion of open water entices Arctic nations with the prospect of easier access to oil and other resources. This morning we talk with Heather Exner-Perot about the nearly unnoticed struggle of Arctic peoples to ensure that the fate of the region they call home is largely in their hands, not in those of Southerners seeking to impose their own political agendas. Heather is the strategist for outreach and Indigenous engagement in the College of Nursing at the University of Saskatchewan and is the author of Whose Arctic Is It?, which appears in State of the World 2015, Confronting Hidden Threats of Sustainability, published by the World Watch Institute. Heather, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how is it that the effects of climate change are really being amplified in the Arctic? What are the how is it being manifest and what's causing it?
Well, I mean, your listeners probably know it's being caused by, you know, more emissions, carbon dioxide, a global warming effect, and it's definitely being manifested. There's no question. It's completely observable. It's observable for a couple of decades now, but as everyone knows, it's the melting sea ice. This is impacting coastlines. It's eroding coastlines where villages are located. It's changing the wildlife. It's changing subsistence traditional practices. And, Alaska is having crazy wildfires. Here where I am in Saskatchewan, we're having unprecedented wildfires as well. It's been smoky in the city for about a week and a half. So everyone can see the impacts. There's no question that there's impacts. That's not what the discussion is about anymore.
Where are you in Saskatchewan, by the way? How far north?
I'm in Saskatoon, yeah. So I'm about 120 kilometers from the boreal forest here where we are.
I'm just about
in the middle, about 200 kilometers from the nearest wildfires here. So, it's been smoky and it's, it's hot, dry weather and it's, attributed partly, if you can, to climate change, partly to El Nino. But it's been unprecedented in Northwest Territories in Alaska. And people are definitely linking it to climate change.
Actually, we're having an unprecedented heat spell here in the Pacific Northwest as well.
Mm-hmm.
And people are very upset about it. They're not used to it being hot for this long. Actually, it's not as hot as it sometimes gets here. But there's a lot of talk of climate change. But what's interesting is that in the North, you've been seeing these changes for a number of years. We've been hearing about all the forest fires in Alaska mm-hmm. now for like 4 or 5 years. So what is... What are the effects? I mean, why is it being amplified? I mean, we've heard about the feedback loops and things. So what is going on that is maybe speeding up the climate change impacts further north than they are down here in the temperate Northwest?
Right. So maybe the most important thing that people might be familiar with also is the albedo effect. So as we all know, white surfaces reflect sunlight and dark surfaces absorb sunlight and energy. So as the ice melts and ice is, light colored or white, then it's absorbing less. So water absorbs a lot more energy than ice does. And so it's amplifying itself. And then the other thing is that, in terms of sea level rise, sea ice itself isn't really contributing to the rise, but it's, the glaciers on top of Greenland and the archipelago in Canada. They're melting off the land and into the ocean. So that's contributing to the sea rise more so than the melting sea ice. So there's those kinds of things. In the Arctic also, you have more industrial kinds of activities, especially in the post-Soviet kind of area, then you're getting more black carbon. So black carbon is a byproduct of industrial activity. It settles on the ice becomes darker or grayer, and that also contributes to that albedo effect. So there's a number of things happening and they all seem to be reinforcing one another. So it's happened much quicker than people ever expected it to happen 10 years ago.
Now, you say there's a lot of industrial activity along the coastal areas in the Arctic. That might surprise people who think of the Arctic as this kind of white wilderness. So where is the industrial activity and what kind is there?
That's a great question. And that's one thing I hope we can talk about today is how people imagine the Arctic as kind of an empty white space. But there's about 4 million people in the Arctic, depending on how you count, and over half are in Russia. So most of the industrial activity has happened in Russia. And it may not always be on the coastlines. In large parts of Siberia, it's more interior. But where there is a lot of activities in the kind of northwest corner of Russia, which is kind of Kalat area or Barents region of northern Scandinavia. And Russia there shares a border with Finland and Norway, and Sweden is there too. So there's most of the people who live in the Arctic are actually in that kind of peninsula of the northwest part of Europe. And so there's been you know, mining, certainly lots of mining, especially on the Russian side, and oil development there for decades.
Well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the North American part of the Arctic, because that's, I think, probably what most North Americans think of, and probably don't even realize that Siberia also shares the Arctic trajectory along with Canada, Greenland, and Alaska. So here in North America, we also have our share of industrialization, even though it's probably not nearly to the extent that it is in Siberia. And actually, in your province in Saskatchewan, in the northwest corner, I understand there's some tar sands exploration and development that's gone on there too. So
yeah.
How do you see that activities that are happening in the Arctic are contributing to climate change, as well as we know that there's a lot more activities happening south of the Arctic that are contributed. But before we get to that and that dichotomy, let's talk about what kinds of activities are going on in Alberta, Saskatchewan, northern BC, and Alaska that might also be raising the temperatures of the planet.
Right. So in those terms that you're thinking about, mostly about black carbon and methane emissions, and that's something that the Arctic Council has been addressing. That's the intergovernmental forum of the 8 Arctic nations. So in terms of what is the Arctic doing that's impacting the Arctic, it's kind of this industrial activity, which isn't negligible, but compared to southern or urban activities, it is negligible given the size of the region that we're talking about. But they're called short-lived climate impacts. So even though there's less emissions, they have a strong short-term effect on climate change. So again, with the black carbon or the methane, they quickly absorb, they quickly warm. And so it has more of a short-term impact than, say, climate or CO2 emissions. So in terms of what you could do in the Arctic, and that what people are looking at doing is limiting carbon emissions, methane emissions from these industrial activities. So they've just recently in April signed a framework agreement to address these. It's, you know, diesel is a huge issue. It is a big emitter of black carbon. And most communities in the Arctic, I mean, they're not on any kind of grid. They need to have a reliable source of energy that wind or solar does not provide at this point. So most of them are reliant on diesel, and that's quite a dirty emitter.
Well, one of the things that's very interesting in your article is looking at the different polls on what to do about the Arctic as we see it warming. And on the one hand, there are environmentalists from around the world who are focusing on the Arctic. Reminds me very much of the way there's a lot of focus on the tropical rainforests. It becomes a global concern to save these regions so that, for one thing, to save them for themselves because they have been pristine, very important ecosystems, and also because if we destroy them, we're destroying the planet because they have played such an important role in basically aerating and cooling the planet. On the other hand, there is there are the industrial forces. Shell oil comes to mind because there's been a lot of contention about Shell oil here in the Pacific Northwest for the last few weeks, wanting to drill in the Arctic. And we hear repeatedly about the wonderful bonanzas that are possibly opening with the Northwest Passage actually becoming a reality in the summer and the sea ice melting, and so the access to all kinds of natural resources that many international forces are all looking at. In your article, you talk about this third force, which is not really considered by most people south of the Arctic Circle, which is the people who live there already and who already have governance and already have concerns. So let's sort of break it down, and let's first talk about the environmental interests that are and why the Arctic plays such an important role in preserving the environment of the entire planet. And then we'll get to the industrial forces and then the native people and kind of look at the tensions between all three.
Right. So we talked a little bit about the, you know, the canary in the coal mine kind of features that the Arctic has. Certainly, I think sea level rise is one of the biggest impacts that, and people, you may know Admiral Papp, he's been nominated or appointed as the special representative of the Arctic, and he often says, what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. So it's this idea that the impacts that you're seeing of climate change in the Arctic are coming back to the south or to the mid-latitudes and impacting there. So, like I said, sea level rise is a big one. Ocean acidification, that's one I think that people are just starting to recognize and starting to understand, but it's happening, you know, quickly, again, quickliest in the Arctic. It has a real impact on shell kind of animals, mollusks and that kind of thing, because the acid affects their ability to calcify and create a shell. And, you know, and it's part of a big food chain, so you can't lose one without losing all the others. So there's acidification, sea level rise, are the main, and then the albedo effect of just reinforcing kind of climate changes and the warming that's happened. And then there, of course, is the weather. And everyone knows that the weather has been weird lately, and it's hard to attribute any of that to, you know, climate change or global warming aside from kind of normal variations. But there has been some evidence recently in the last 2 years of people looking if, you know, if the Arctic, the warming weather there is affecting the jet stream, which is affecting, you know, the cold northeastern winter, kind of longer weather incidents. So, you know, slow changes. Weather where, you know, a trough might, you know, stay over an area for a longer period of time than it used to. Colder weather as Greenland, you know, melts and ice melts and goes into the North Atlantic, that'll change the currents and will make Europe colder. And perhaps it's all also making where you are drier and hotter as well. So there has been some good evidence in the last year or two to suggest that, yes, that the melting ice and the effect it's having on ocean currents is also impacting the weather.
So what is your sense about environmental groups who are really focusing on different activities to protect the Arctic and to slow down climate change? Do you feel that there's some real genuine concerns that need to be addressed?
Well, certainly climate change is a genuine concern, but I question, you know, we're kind of jumping to the forward things, but I question focusing, you know, thinking that stopping Arctic climate change is going to stop climate change. So the Arctic is the victim of all this. It's not the main contributor. So in some of these ways, these are albedo effects or outcomes of the warming in the Arctic, but it never originated in the Arctic. And oil drilling and emissions, they're not really originating from the Arctic either. So all this occurred kind of from southern uses. And when I say southern, I say that, you know, very, very broadly, anything south of, say, the 60th parallel. So most of what's happened in the Arctic is a result of these emissions that we've had in the south and in urban areas, and it's impacting it. So where I have some concerns is when, you know, organizations like Greenpeace or others try to mitigate climate change by focusing on activities in the Arctic, when in fact it's not activities in the Arctic that cause climate change in the first place.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Heather Eckner-Perot, and she's the author of an article in the annual State of the World books that the World Watch Institute puts out. This one's called Confronting Hidden Threats to Sustainability, and her article is called Whose Arctic Is It? And we're talking about the specific issues in the Arctic around climate change and also some questions that are not often looked at about whose role is it really to determine what happens in the Arctic, and how do we make sure that the people who live in the Arctic actually have a very strong say in that. Let's talk about the another force at play here, which is the industrial force, which sees climate change as a great opportunity. And we've definitely seen this in Northern Europe, and particularly, I think, in Russia, about, you know, trying to extract more oil or whatever they think they can get by having more access to the Arctic Ocean. But there's also a lot happening in northern Alaska, and we saw that with the protests against the Shell oil rig that was getting worked on in the Seattle port up until last week to get ready to go up to Alaska and do some exploratory drilling. So what is your sense about that attitude of, like, the again, I guess what you're concerned about is the Arctic is seen by people in the South as a free-for-all whenever, for whatever our agenda is. So what's your sense about the industrial petrochemical view that this is a great opportunity for more exploration and extraction, and this will give us more oil to burn for the next 50 years?
Right. Well, there was the thing that everyone cites is the United States Geological Survey in 2008 updated its Arctic estimates, and they were significant. So according to the USGS, it's probably about 17% of oil and maybe 25-28% of the world's remaining gas deposits in the Arctic. Now, the Arctic is a very large area, so Maybe that's not surprising, but anyways, these are mostly untapped is the point. So if you want to look for extra resources, and you know, before we peak, there's still quite a bit left in the Arctic. But that being said, they're extremely difficult to get out. It's extremely difficult, expensive area to operate in, and with today's gas prices, there's no doubt that it's not profitable at all. So again, this came out in 2008, just when gas was peaking there at around $145 a barrel, and there was a commodities kind of super cycle happening, and the Arctic was seen, you know, then it would have been profitable, and people were starting to look in the Arctic because at those prices you could have made money on iron ore and nickel and other things as well. But it has not happened, and the prices have gone down, and we're not sure if they'll go up again since China's demand has gone down, and there's no one that looks set to replace China, and Europe is in decline demographically as well. So no one knows when or if there's going to be another big commodity super cycle like that one, and no one knows if oil and gas are going to be, you know, the preferred energy sources if and when, you know, it goes back to $150 a barrel. So that's kind of one mark against it. So people expect that there already is drilling. There is hardly any drilling in the Arctic. And again, as you say, what Shell is doing is exploratory drilling.
Actually, I want to talk a bit more about that, because I think the lesson, people were very surprised that Shell's back up there this summer, because you would have thought after the disaster of the Kulik in 2012 that they would be a little gun shy about going back. But I think that there's other forces. My understanding is that Shell has, in order to keep their stock prices up, they have to keep their oil reserves high. And most of the reserves that they have now are up in the Arctic, whether they can get them or not. So what's your sense about a company like Shell, which seems to be really determined to get up there and drill?
Yeah, well, I'm surprised too. You know, they're facing so many obstacles. Is this the right time? But you just pointed out too, you know, what kind of we're all suspecting is that, yes, they're just trying to have higher proven resources, which increases, like you say, their share price. So if Shell, even if they have no intention of drilling in the Arctic, if they can prove that they have resources, drillable resources in the Arctic, and they've already paid, you know, in the order of a couple billion dollars for the leases there, then that makes their investors in the long term more supportive of them. So even if Shell has no intentions in the next 10 or even 20 years to drill, they can still say that they have these reserves, and it gets factored into their price. Now, other companies have pulled out. You know, they have spent the money on the leases in Alaska and in the seas there, but they've said, no, they're not going to even explore yet. And if anyone, you know, if you don't like Shell and you think, you know, Shell is evil and all those things, then you should be glad that they're in the Arctic, because they spent $7 billion on basically nothing. They spent $7 billion with not a penny to show for it. So this has been, in my opinion, disastrous for Shell on a number of levels. People are surprised they went back up there this year, but it's probably for the long-term share price that they're up there for in the first place.
And then they might not be able to find a home in Seattle when they have to leave Alaska, because there's a good chance
maybe they'll have to go to Bellingham. Who knows?
They may be like a ship, sort of like a Beethoven ship without a country. You know, they just travel around the world.
Yeah.
Well, there's this irony, which you talk about in your article, that is really perceived with a great deal of apprehension by environmental activists, that the climate change has created at least the illusion that these oil reserves are now tappable, but there's concern that if these oil reserves are tapped, it's just going to exacerbate climate change. So how do you see that dilemma?
Well, I mean, it is a horrible paradox, and I don't think anyone can disagree. Yeah, it's a terrible thing that climate change has created this. But there's a different way to look at it, too, which is what I try to explain in the chapter. So if you're a southerner or an environmentalist, you see the Arctic, you see it's either climate change or less climate change. And the easy answer is to want less climate change and to want more environmental protection. But if you're a northerner, the options are different. It's jobs or no jobs. And there aren't really other opportunities for jobs and for resource, for any kind of development without exploiting resources, whether that be fish or mining or oil exploration. So in the last 30 or 40 years, as I explained, there's been a big shift towards more self-determination for Indigenous and other northern peoples in Greenland, in Canada and Alaska, a little bit in the Nordic countries, and not as much in Russia at all, but certainly Alaska, Canada and Greenland. And they've been quite successful. So there's been a lot of evolution of governing powers and the ability to oversee, you know, regulations and see environmental impact assessments. And can we have something called a duty to consult? So all these big, large resource projects cannot go ahead without consulting consulting the responsible, whether it's the chiefs or the tribal councils or different boards that they have in place. And in often these cases, there's what we call impact benefit agreements, so that if there is resource development that's clearly articulated, the kinds of jobs, the kinds of profits, the kind of revenues, the kinds of opportunities that will stream to the northern communities themselves. So it has changed in the last 30 or 40 years, where basically 40 years ago, Northerners, Indigenous people especially, got basically no benefits from resource development, but they had to absorb all the risks and all the disadvantages. So they were left with kind of the environmental destruction, disrupted their traditional ways of living. But in the last 10, 20 years, we're seeing that they have a lot more say in how these proceed, on what basis they proceed, and that they benefit also from it.
I'm wondering how. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering how the kind of control and the relationship that the Indigenous people in the North have towards this kind of development compares to a little further south in BC and Alberta, where the Indigenous people are really, I mean, they've gotten Supreme Court backing for their claim that they have final say over these projects. And it looks quite likely that the Indigenous people in the First Nations in BC are stopping the Northern Gateway pipeline because the majority don't see it in their interest. However, there is a split within the First Nations community, as far as I can tell, and there's a small minority of people that see benefit to these projects. So I'm wondering, is that same kind of tension and diverse opinions playing out in the North as well?
That's everywhere. So that's in Alaska, it's in northern Canada, and it's in Greenland. This split, and maybe it's not unlike the split that we have, you know, further south between environmental protection and economic development. And what is the balance? And can there possibly be a balance if you're talking about climate change and oil emissions, carbon dioxide emissions? So there's so it's very divisive, and this is a new kind of argument. I think 20 years ago there was much more consensus when there were no benefits accruing to northern communities that they just did not want it to happen. But now that the carrots are on offer as well as the sticks, then I think, you know, they're having these conversations. They're very difficult conversations, and I don't think, you know, it's very gray. There's no black and white. I don't think there's easy answers here. A lot of these communities are impoverished. There are no jobs. There's a lot of dependency on government, which has led to a lot of social dysfunction. And so how do you get out of this? How do you get out of this rot or this cycle without jobs, without economic development, without governance and revenues going towards Indigenous governments and northern governments so they can do what they want to do without having to rely on Washington, D.C. or Ottawa or Copenhagen? And Greenland is the most, you know, interesting or clear case where this is an issue. So Greenland got home rule in 1979, and a couple years ago they got a little bit more strengthened governance powers also with self-rule. So basically they have governing powers almost over anything but defense and currency and foreign affairs. But they really
just to back up a second. People might not know that Greenland is actually basically a colony of Denmark.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't want to be a colony anymore. So it's still under the, it's part of the Kingdom of Denmark, and they would like to have independence. Well, how, and there's many reasons, you know, why everyone supports basically the principle that self-determination leads to the best governance, and especially, you know, the values and the traditions and the culture is so different between Greenland and Denmark. You can see why Greenland would want to make its own rules and its own laws. But how are they going to get independence? And they still rely on about $650 million of transfers from Denmark every year, which works out to about $11,000 or $12,000 per person. So the only option for Greenland, it's kind of a catch-22, you know, that they want to be independent, but that requires that they get $650 million a year, roughly, in resource revenues. That there's very other limited options that they're ever going to generate that kind of revenue with about 58,000 people.
You have an interesting... Continue.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so, you know, when you say there should be moratoriums on drilling or that this should not happen in the Arctic, you're also saying, basically, Greenland, you can never be independent from Denmark.
Well, in your book, you have this interesting line where you talk about sustainability is about more than just environmental sustainability, and it has to do with basically community sustainability, which has to do with jobs and other kinds of resources. How do Indigenous people in the North view this, and do you think that they maybe can find a way to balance the need to extract some of the resources in their land versus protecting the ecology and the basic natural services that the land provides?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, do you think been able to do that anywhere else.
No.
So what is the balance that people are willing to accept? And this is, you know, where I get frustrated, or I see why Northerners are frustrated, is that for people in the South, they think the balance in the Arctic is zero development. That is the balance that they seek to achieve. It should be zero. And if you're up there and, you know, you have kids to feed, or you want to stay up there, you don't want to have to move, you want your government to be able to make decisions about its schools, about its healthcare system, without having to go to, you know, Copenhagen or Ottawa first to make these decisions and get funding and beg for funding, then it becomes a very difficult decision. It's not just environmental protection, and there's no going back. I think people also have an idea that all the people in the North, especially the Indigenous peoples, are totally subsistence, totally traditional lifestyle still, and that's not the case. And, you know, they've been settled now, you know, forcibly settled a couple of decades ago, but at any rate, now they're settled, and you can't have villages and cities and still rely, the carrying capacity of the land for the number of people now living in the Arctic is much higher. So you can't have, you know, you can't go to school and get an education and still hunt enough to feed yourself and your family full time. So these are difficult questions. There are no good answers, or there are no easy answers, I should say. So people are struggling with how much to maintain a traditional lifestyle, how much to maintain the land and the link to the land, but also have options, have an education, have jobs, have professions, have their own government, have their own healthcare system. So it's just very difficult, and I don't think people in the South tend to respect that these are the same kinds of decisions. You know, they're making those same kind of decisions as we want to have the right to make down South.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Heather Exner-Perot, who is the author of an article called Whose Arctic Is It, that appears in State of the World 2015, Confronting Hidden Threats to Sustainability, published by the World Watch Institute. And we're talking about some of the realities in the Arctic that are not really appreciated, I guess, by a lot of people who live below the Arctic Circle. I think one of the main ones that you keep stressing is that the area is populated. And you talk in the book about how one of the myths that people in the South have about the Arctic is there's no governance. So let's talk a bit about what kind of governance there is and how that may be a means to solve some of the problems that we're talking about today.
Yeah, that's a great question. And again, yeah, there is sometimes this idea that it's, you know, again, kind of a Wild West, that no one's in charge, and that, you know, companies like Shell can just go in there and do whatever they want, and that there's no oversight and no regulations, and that's just blatantly untrue. So there's all the regulations that you would have in any offshore situations. We're talking about oil drilling or mining. But there's usually many, many more in the Arctic, certainly in the North American Arctic, including Greenland. Russia, again, is kind of a very different case. Actually, so is Northern Scandinavia, because they're much more, I guess, like Northern BC or the Provincial North, because they have a much higher population. And it's not quite as cold because they get the warm current going up their coast. But anyway, so there's several layers of governance. There's international layers, and some of this is, you know, United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea is the biggest one, probably, to regulate ocean governance in the Arctic. But also most of the international agreements the eight Arctic states are party to, so transboundary issues, International Maritime Organization, all the kind of standard ones are all applicable in the Arctic. It doesn't end, you know, at the Arctic Circle. They still apply in the Arctic. Then there's national regulations, and in many cases these will be more robust in the Arctic. In some cases they'll be about the same, but I mean, everyone is very concerned, even Russia, everyone pays lip service, but also there's been, you know, money spent on monitoring, implementation, those kinds of things. Can you ever argue it's enough? Probably not, but you can't say there's been no efforts put in. And then in the Arctic, there's many different local or kind of sub-regional things going on. So in Alaska, you have the state government, obviously. In Canada, we have the three territories that have their own layers of regulation and their own processes. And then you might, on top of that, have some indigenous communities that have some self-determination over some land claims, as we call them, and they'll have additional processes. So imagine if you're a mining company and you want to do some mining in Northwest Territories, for example, and of course this happens, you'll have to get approval from the indigenous communities, and there might be five or six or even seven of them with different processes, different boards. You have to get approval from the territorial government. You have to get approval from Environment Canada, and this can take a very long time. So on average, probably the from the start to beginning to the end is probably a decade before approvals will be granted for these kinds of mega projects. And the poor consequence of that, people might be very happy, okay, there's lots of regulation, that's very good, but the offset of that is that there's almost no room for small and medium-sized enterprises because the processes and the sizes that require all this legal and accounting information kind of prices them out. So only big multinational corporations with, you know, the ability to wait a decade before they make any kinds of profits have the ability to operate in the Arctic. And basically every project in the Arctic is a mega-billion dollar project.
How do you see the making it possible for small, local, and probably perhaps indigenous-owned operations to be able to operate up there? And what you're saying sort of reinforces that view that a lot of people in the South have, which is that everybody who's exploiting the Arctic are these big multinational corporations.
Yeah, well, that is true. So what's been done, again, I mentioned impact-benefit agreements, and I'll have different names, but roughly the same principle is subcontracting. So there'll be deals for things like the catering or the janitorial services or kind of the laborers where they'll have deals. And sometimes it's right in the agreement that, you know 10% or 20% or 40% must be indigenous workforce or must be subcontracting or, you know, $100 million out of a billion must be an indigenous-owned company and that kind of thing. So that's how, in some cases, this is starting to work very well, I have to say. And it's creating a lot of employment. And this is where, you know, the alignment kind of indigenous activists with environmentalists might start to be switching to pro-development because they're starting to see benefits from it. So that's interesting. In Alaska, people don't know this, but back in the 70s when they devolved, they established 13 Alaska Native corporations, and 8 of those are the top 10 biggest companies in Alaska. So 8 of the top 10 biggest companies in Alaska are Native corporations.
Well, I was thinking about in British Columbia, where I'm a little bit more familiar with what's going on in the tensions between the First Nations and the petrochemical developers, particularly Kinder Morgan and Enbridge, that I know that the Tsleil-Waututh and the Coastal Salish, who have been really opposed to both the Trans Mountain Pipeline and the Northern Gateway Pipeline, when they look at the benefits that would possibly be coming to them, and both of those tribes have decided that the benefits are far outweighed by the problems and the environmental impact, but they're concerned that they aren't getting the great jobs, that they're basically the main work opportunities for First Nations people would be cleaning up oil spills. So I wonder if that's not an issue along the coast of the potential coast of the Arctic Ocean and in the communities that are further north.
Well, I mean, it certainly is an issue. High school graduation rates are abysmal in many of these communities. Post-secondary attainment is abysmal in many of these communities. But there's also a question. So, I mean, but a lot of work is being done on that. But that's for the government to do and for the communities to do. It's not up to Shell to make sure that there's a better high school graduation rate. And I start to get concerned with these big impact benefit agreements is that, you know, it leaves the state out or the state kind of abdicates from its responsibility. So the state has to be there to increase education and to increase health outcomes, and it's not up to the corporations to basically be kind of de facto governments in these areas. So I think we can't abdicate state responsibility on these hugely important indicators. But in general, the trend almost everywhere is positive in terms of secondary high school completion, post-secondary attainment. And so I think companies are very, very willing to hire Indigenous peoples, Aboriginal peoples into bigger, you know, better paying positions, more of the white collar as opposed to the blue collar. But there's a lot of work that has to be done in the communities to increase their educational rate. And that work is being done, but it takes a long time. That's a generational kind of issue. Well, but the BC situation is incredibly interesting, and I mean, your readers may not be or your listeners, I should say, but they turned down $1 billion offer. Their impact benefit agreement offer was $1 billion for a community of a couple hundred people, and they turned that down. So that is a hugely interesting case, and maybe we should all be very gratified that they had the option to accept it or to turn it down, even when that kind of money was on the table. So the system seems to be working when a small group of a couple hundred people can turn that kind of money down.
What does that say to you that they turn it down, that they really see that the damages that would arise from accepting the benefits are not worth multi-billion dollars?
Yeah, well, and that was their right, and that was their analysis. But I promise you there are other Indigenous communities in Canada that would not turn down $1 billion.
I'm just kind of curious, what was the response in some of the communities, particularly in Saskatchewan and Alberta, to watching the BC First Nations turn down the agreement?
Well, I'll say mostly surprise, and I also sit on the Saskatchewan First Nations Economic Development Network board, a lot of communities wish that they had that opportunity to accept or turn down that kind of money. And some are doing, some have done very well with oil revenues. And I mean that they've done well with actually building their communities, building their nations, and building infrastructure to promote prosperity and options for their community members. So this is where I'm coming from. It's not that I'm pro-oil or pro-climate change, but I've seen that, the alternative can be pretty desperate.
The Tsleil-Waututh, who actually their reservation is right inside North Vancouver, they are building wind and solar facilities. And so they're not just like saying no to development. They're just saying no to petrochemical development and are concerned about, so they're really trying to create alternatives and also to create ways to create more revenue and to be more sustainable economically for their community through renewable energy and other, let's call it, earth-friendly kinds of procedures. So I think there's a concern that if the First Nations in the Arctic do buy into some of these settlement agreements and decide on their own that they wanted to exploit the oil, that it could be really detrimental, not just to the rest of the planet, but also to them. And so I'm wondering how that's being balanced.
Well, like I say, it's not a lot of it is happening yet. There have been no oil spills in Canadian Arctic. There's been very little drilling in the Canadian Arctic, and it's actually pretty hard to drill on the Canadian side. You have a bit of a warmer current through Alaska that makes it a bit more likely or less difficult or less risky, but still obviously extremely risky. There's been a lot more development, again, on the Norwegian side because they do have warmer currents, so the ice isn't quite an issue up there. But the balance question, this is what communities are talking, these are the discussions that are happening at kitchen tables all over the Arctic, is what is the balance? And pipelines are very detrimental to herds, so a lot of them are relying on reindeer or caribou, depending on where you are in the Arctic. And pipelines can be very detrimental to the movement of the herds and going to birthing grounds or feeding and that kind of thing. So that's a huge issue. And then when you talk about offshore, again, they're very dependent, for example, on whaling. And shipping and offshore development can really impact whales and their movement and where they breed and where they migrate to. So those are kind of the bigger issues, is what will they eat? But at the same time, the reliance on traditional foods has been declining, on country foods has been declining. So it's not true that they're 100% reliant on country foods as it is. So it's this kind of, what are you trying to preserve, and is it possible to preserve that, or is it better to modernize and kind of embrace this different kind of development kind of society? And that's, again, these are the conversations that happen every day across the Arctic, and there's no great answer, there's no great solution to this problem.
Well, I'll be very interested to continue to watch this and see how it evolves in the next decade or so. So it's something that's very good for us south of the Arctic Circle to be aware of and to think about. So I want to thank you very much for joining us, Heather.
Okay, thank you very much.
We've been talking this morning with Heather Exner-Pirot, who's author of Whose Arctic Is It?, which appears in the State of the World 2015, Confronting Hidden Threats to Sustainability. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll talk with another contributor to this book, World Watch Institute's State of the World 2015 anthology. He's Nathan Hagens, author of Energy, Credit, and the End of Growth. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with a little bit of music by Alan Toussaint, who I had the great opportunity to hear at the Blues Festival on Friday. So it's not much about the Arctic, but maybe it's about having a very strong determination to move forward. So Alan Toussaint and Yes We Can. Thanks for listening.
Now is the time for all good men to get together with one another, iron out their problems and iron out their quarrels, and try to live as brothers.
and try to find peace within without stepping on one another. And due respect to the women of the world, just remember we all had mothers.
Make this land a better land in the world in which we live.
And help each man be a better man with the kindness that you give. And I know we can make it.
I know that we can.
I know done well we can work it out. I know we can make it work.
I know that we can.
I know we can make it if we try.
Oh yes we can, I know we can, can. Yes we can, great gosh almighty. Yes we can, I know we can, can.
And it's just a half a minute before 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Health Watch. Today, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with Dr. Gerald Mullen, Associate Professor of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University, about his book, The Gut Balance Revolution. And at 11:30, it's Madness Radio with host Will Hall. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Should it be harder for landlords to evict their tenants for no reason at all?
Should safe and healthy homes come before the interests of private investment?
Is the rent too damn high?
If you answered yes to any of these questions, join us for the next Portland Renters Assembly.
KBOO is a proud sponsor of the Portland Renters Assembly, a gathering of people united by the burden of rent and committed to housing as a human right.
The next two assemblies are on Sunday, July 12th, from 12 to 2 p.m. at the North Portland Library, with speakers on how race intersects with gentrification.
And on Wednesday, July 15th, from 6 to 8 p.m. at Colonel Sumner's Park, with speakers on community organizing and mobilizing.
Tell your story and join the conversation. For more information, go to kboo.fm and click on Community Events.